I will just say, I really appreciate you folks for inviting me onto this. And I think this is actually a really, really important subject matter to talk about and discuss. Actually, if I could just say real quick, just after you mentioned what the subject matter was going to be, I typically on a daily basis have a lot of windows open because there's, you know, just like a lot of people that get really deep into stuff. You got a lot of information that you consume in the run of a day. And I got to tell you, probably 3/4 of the articles that were open on my tabs all literally dealt with, you could find somewhere in there where there's a public-private partnership somewhere along the way. So it's permeating through everything where government and corporations are very, very much intertwined these days.
Totally. Bennett, I couldn't agree more. This is Dave, and I think I'm finally on. Did I catch the button?
Oh, yeah. We hear Yay. You.
Great.
Clear.
Yay.
Excellent.
That was easy.
So we're good to get started now. Bennett, thanks for that little intro there about public-private partnerships. So we want to talk about this from the American perspective. Of course, David wanted to come in and talk about how the Biden administration is using these to run the country. But I thought it'd be, you know, we have a lot of Canadians on ThinkSpot, and I thought it'd be great to have the Canadian point of view as well. Different system up there, different things going on. So I was hoping to hear from both of you and your take on what's going on, what to look out for. But why don't we start with a short intro? And just for the record, we're this will be up on ThinkSpot later as a recording. So just think of this as, you know, somebody might be listening to you in the future as well with your introduction. So David, please go ahead.
Well, I've been on Wall Street for 50 years now, believe it or not. And when I started, Wall Street was an entirely different animal than it is today. It had about a third in assets of what the size of the total economy is. Today, Wall Street is 1.5 times larger than the economy itself. I started with a firm called E.F. Hutton, which you might remember from long ago. And Hutton, like most of Wall Street, was a partnership. A partnership meant that each of the partners actually had to pony up the money to run the company. And if they made a mistake, it came right out of their pockets. So Wall Street back in the day was extremely, extremely conservative. And believe it or not, it was only 43 years after the stock market crash of 1929. And most of the senior executives on Wall Street were in their 60s, and they remembered the crash. And so they looked back and they were very, very conservative people. They did not believe in leverage. Believe it or not, they thought some stocks were even too risky at the time, and they were a place where a lot of bond trading went on. Flash forward to today, and we're almost at the opposite end of that schedule, with leverage being the single most important thing probably on Wall Street. We're seeing after we went through about 10 years of zero interest rate policy by the Federal Reserve, which lowered the cost of leverage, the cost of borrowing. And it saw a lot of companies that instead of financing through stocks, that was ownership, they instead financed through borrowing. You have a company like Home Depot and most of the retailers, frankly, who have the vast majority of their capital is borrowed. And now, of course, we're going into higher interest rates, and a lot of those companies are being very seriously squeezed. So anyway, it's been a long run. I've met a lot of great people on the way. And I'm looking forward to this discussion tonight.
Great. Thanks, David. And Bennett, would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself as well?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, my name is Bennett Hunter. I go by the username Canadian Libertarian on all the social media. I'm just basically a blue collar kind of a guy. I've been in the trucking industry for most of my life and construction typically. But there have been a lot of things that have happened, in particular, you could all the way back to the dot-com bubble stuff, but there's been so many things that have happened in this new century that just seemed to be so off base. And of course, you know, I pay attention to things that are going on. And as a truck driver, you get all kinds of time to listen to things. And I started paying attention to people like, I'm not sure if you folks remember, but I'm sure you are. There was especially if you're American, during the election of 2008 and 2012, there was this guy, Ron Paul, and he seemed to be completely antithetical to the typical politician or anything that I've ever heard from, the typical rhetoric and talking points and lines. He was saying things that just shocked my sensibilities because I've never heard someone in the political realm talk so honestly and openly and against government, right? So it really piqued my interest. And then, of course, you start down that rabbit hole. And I do have, now, once again, a blue-collar background, but I'm very much into problem solving. So I've been building engines since I was a teenager. 18 years old, I built my first engine. And just off of being knowledge that was self-taught, watching other people and stuff like that. And so I got to thinking, what's going on with all this? Like, why is all this stuff taking place? Why is the economy's always, you know, up and down? So, of course, you go down these paths. I learned about Austrian economics. And that was actually a major contributing factor that kind of helped spark my interest in economics, because as I was understanding how most people today, they're taught basically it's the Keynesian economics. And of course, once you start down the Keynesian economics road, as the phrase was coined, is, yeah, we're all Keynesians now, right? And that was that moral hazard in the beginning of using government to pay it over whether it's malinvestment or overexpending or a lack of saving, basically to prop up the economy. And I could see, even when they made the argument back in the day, and this is, of course, you know, after wars and stuff, I can understand the case being made at the time. But once again, once you start down that road, right? And to me, whether you go back to then or to today, or let's just go to 2008, once again, one of those moral hazards in terms of the bailouts, oh, they're just too big to fail, right? Too big to fail. Well, look at what that has gotten us today. I mean, as a parent, as a father, you know, there has to be some kind of structure or limitations in the kind of things that you would allow in any sensible, when you see that there's perils and dangers on that. But what we're seeing is that coming to fruition in real life, where these bailouts and using Keynesian economics, although I would say nowadays we're kind of, I would say we're either approaching or already in a world of MMT. And I'm not sure if you folks are familiar, but I had a conversation, well, I guess you could say an informal debate, with Warren Mosler, which is one of the key proponents and figureheads of modern monetary theory. And we're talking about folks that have taken Keynesian economics and put it on steroids. And that, to me, and if you understand economics, which I'm sure you folks do, is this is getting into some really, really perilous and dangerous territory. But anyways, I'll just say that first and foremost, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, and David, do you want to follow up on any of that?
No, I just absolutely agree with Bennett. And interestingly, my mic wasn't working when he was giving his other introduction, but he's absolutely right in that all of the headlines today are exactly aimed at this new public-private partnership, which Biden is doing to a fare-thee-well. I mean, the guy is unbelievable in terms of how much he's putting into public-private partnership. You might forget that the very first thing he did in his administration was announced a public-private partnership of $1.2 trillion to rebuild the infrastructure, get new jobs, and so on. All of that $1.2 trillion was earmarked to these private corporate partners of the government public-private partnership ideal. It's remarkable how much he's pushed us in that direction. And a little later, I thought we might just go through some of the headlines that we're seeing today, all of which show that government wants to control the situation, but offload the production of a product or the giving of a service to a private partnership so that they can get away from all of the financing and away from some of the control, I think.
Can I just actually just respond real quick to that, if you folks don't mind?
Yeah, of course. I think we'll just keep this conversational. You guys feel free to go back and forth. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, so here's the thing that I like to do typically when I have any kind of in-depth discussion is let's define our terms. And I don't mean, you know, from people that think that they can just reinvent the language and define them to mean whatever they damn well please. I'm talking about let's just, you know, as far as I'm concerned, whenever you have these kind of conversations with anybody, friend or foe, I think everyone should have a copy of a dictionary on hand, because this I find to be one of the biggest problems and why most of the communications that are taking place these days are not just in echo chambers and not reached across these divides, but even people that seem to be on the same side per se don't seem to grasp these things. So let me just say first and foremost is if you look up what a corporation is, and this is the first problem, you know, prior to this third way, these mixed economies, you know, like, you know, there was many iterations in the 20th century, fascism, Nazism, socialism, communism, right? All kinds of these collectivist ideologies and different iterations of basically forced subjugation of the individual to the collective. But the thing is, a corporation, what it is, what distinguishes a corporation from what we would have, maybe if you're a little bit older and you grew up and just thought of, you know, a mom and pop, a business, a store, right? The difference between a business or a store is a corporation is actually a legal fiction. And not enough people talk about this. And it's not that I'm against people who run businesses, but that was the first step in capture, right? That was that first step in that really cozy relationship between public and private partnerships, because a corporation is a legal fiction created as an act of legislation. So in the absence of legislation that creates the term and the rules set up for these corporations, well, a business would have no pretense, right? In any kind of proper market, they would in function in any kind of market, sure, you could succeed. You could be wealthy beyond belief if you offer a product and service, but you don't get to socialize or offload, you know, any of the downfalls or the losses that you may incur. That to me was one of the biggest problem. And that's another thing I think that has contributed to why, you know, there was probably lots of people, especially I would say, you know, maybe decades ago, maybe some of the Ayn Randists and the Objectivists that would have been more antithetical. And even though they were corporations, that's the thing. When you see that the people that are benefiting, your competition in any particular field, are benefiting themselves greatly by, you know, entangling alliance with government and having such a cozy relationship and all the benefits and perks that come from, well, that's that incentive structure that has literally forced and thrust a lot of the really probably, you know, typically ethical and decent business oriented practices that typically would have been done, is they've had to all gravitate towards basically doing the same thing. Because if you want to survive in this current crony corporatist system, you basically have to, right?
That's kind of what I was getting at too, Bennett. I agree. There's the relationship. And the issue here is, are we going to have a free market system where corporations have to go out and win customers by offering better products and better pricing? Or are we going to have, in your terms, a crony capitalism? And we're getting awfully close to the crony capitalism, I'm afraid. One of the big headlines that I marked down was the fact that in the Ukraine war, the 155 millimeter artillery shells, we've run out of them, or we cannot produce them fast enough. Mm-hmm. So if you do a little research into that, you find out that General Dynamics has the only 155 factory in the country. They're up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, just a little north of me here. Mm-hmm. And the point is that they've had a government contract since 1964. And consequently, they haven't really had to work for it. There's been no competitor who's come into that marketplace and said, we'll build a better product, we'll make it cheaper. That's excluded in this public-private partnership that we're talking about. And we see that all the way through our entire industrial base right now, which is decaying because it's getting much too old.
Oh, well, no doubt about it. And I assure you, I've been in the U.S. A lot of times. I spent, 9 years driving long haul, and most of my time was actually spent in the U.S.
Interesting.
And being the kind of talkative guy I am, I definitely, you know, engage with a lot of people. So I understand. But I got to tell you, here in Canada, which is why I'm glad you folks brought me on here, but it is getting to the point here in Canada that it is almost indistinguishable. And once again, I want to parse things out right now by saying not all, you know, there's definitely some good people out there, some great entrepreneurs, some business owners, some great minds in the business community that find themselves in these strange, peculiar positions. But that fast track race to the bottom, where you either, you know, get on board with cozying up and being part of that third way, that system. See, that's the thing. Let me just say this real quick, is I think what it is, you know, people are taught. And this is where people are just failed so miserably in so many ways in terms of being properly educated and informed. But, you know, people would suggest, most people at least, would be, you know, the parasitical types are the people on the left, the socialists. But there's a lot of people in the business community that still take that upon themselves, and they've just found a different way. So rather than voting, right, they just become, like I say, part and parcel of the system and greatly benefit themselves by, you know, using that regulatory capture or making it so that it's almost impossible. And it creates so many barriers of entry for any new upstarts. But in Canada, almost every segment, major segment of our economy is basically run by, you know, could be as little as two or three major corporations. And of course, these major corporations, whether you're talking about the airline industry, the telecommunications, well, I mean, the banks, we got six, but I mean, even six, that's pretty, in terms of the big banks that basically rule the roost and have the monopoly on most of the banking in this country. And once again, that all these things contribute to the fact, because there's multiple ways that you can be parasitical, but the corporate class, the crony corporate class, have figured out a much better way than the average low Joe Blow or someone that just wants to get a check or a handout, you know, your typical leftist, let's say. Now, these are people that are greatly and massively enriching themselves by cozying up and having that very close relationship with the state. And once again, it's all coming at the people who aren't in that position at our expense, because somebody's going to have to pay the cost at some point in time.
Now, I got a question. How do I become the guy with the really lazy munitions factory that has the cozy deal with the government? How do I get that gig?
Yes. Well, you had to be there in 1964 to get that one. But here's part of the problem. We have elected now a president who's gone far beyond what's anything reasonable, and he is now setting the rules. And so, whereas, like in a defense contractor, he's got an automatic market. He's going to immediately sell those 155 millimeter shells, no doubt about it. But Biden has gone beyond that. And he says, essentially has said, I'm smarter than the marketplace. I'm going to tell the country where they ought to be. So they announced a public-private partnership for the production of electric vehicles. And the goal was to have half of all the vehicles made in 2030 in the United States be electric. And initially, everyone signed up for it. All the automobile makers signed up for it precisely because, Nathan, exactly what you're talking about. They wanted to be the cushy guy who got in on the deal, get there first, and just make it. Well, the end result is, and we're less than 2 years into this project, the end result is Ford just came out and said, we're projecting that we'll lose $4.5 billion on this electric vehicle product. We're going to have to get out. We can't stay in this thing. And so Ford is hitting the exits on this. And this is the real difference between, I agree, Pierre Elliott Trudeau is horrible, but he's not creating a $7 trillion government budget to go out and do every whim and wish that he wants to do, unlike Joe Biden.
Mm. Well, yeah, and I mean, it just like your side of this talk, I'm probably going to combat things with a little bit different way. But my biggest concern with the whole public-private partnership at this particular junction is it's kind of a little bit more in the philosophical realm, more or less, but in terms of how people perceive things. So what I'm seeing today is younger generations. Now, like I say, even if you're talking about the people that identify in the left, there's definitely a huge substantial cohort of younger generations that are completely disenfranchised with the status quo with the current system. You're seeing it, like I say, whether it's the people that want to identify on the right or the left, or even just people are just, you know, caught in the middle and don't really have much political persuasion, but they see that things just aren't right. And it's an easy case to make, especially for a libertarian like myself. It's an easy case to make because the root cause, you know, whether you're talking about corporations, this, the root cause, you can always find that trajectory. It all leads right back to the state at the end of the day. The problem is with these public-private partnerships is, and I'm typically the kind of guy that, you know, I like to tout someone like Elon Musk, you know, for the fact there's some positive and some pros and some cons here that I look at it. So Elon Musk, and of course, all of his businesses, he's had to play game with government. So, of course, he's had to be subsidized and all that kind of stuff. But he'll even admit that it's not that he wants to. It's just that if he doesn't and everyone else does, it puts him at a great disadvantage. But I seen someone like Elon Musk, and I actually have the Starlink, and I was quite impressed. He even has written into the contract for Starlink that basically your contract is between you and the corporation once you leave Earth's atmosphere. So let's say there's a Mars colony here in, you know, whatever, 25 years. Well, you're not going to be functioning under American laws or Canadian laws. You're going to be functioning under basically laws between you, or they would just be, I guess, rules, I guess, between policies, right? And between you and the business. Now, right now, because the business is typically, right now as it is, nobody believes that a corporation has any authority to dictate my life, to plunder my income, to do any of the things that the state does. So it's a pretty easy way to paint the target on the thing that's antithetical to individual freedom and liberty, and especially economic freedom and liberty, is government. But as they get closer and closer and more intertwined, intertangled, and they become to the point where is the corporation, my biggest concern, is the corporation going to become the new state?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's a big debate going on right now on whether we're heading towards a fascist state or a socialist state. And the difference is that in a fascist state, you're very close to what you're talking about, Bennett. In a fascist state, the control of or the influence of the corporation is huge. Hmm. And it does have a great deal of sway over the government. In the socialist state, the ideal, the Marxist ideal, is that the government owns the means of production. The government owns the corporation. In the fascist state, an individual own, or the private sector owns the corporation, but the corporation has a great deal of influence and access over government. Government's role here in a lot of this, when you're talking about Starlink and so on, is really the enforcement of contract. And that's where the law comes in. So when Starlink has when you have an agreement with Starlink, it's really a question of what does the contract say? What does that big long thing you had online and you agreed and signed off to? The right. Government's role then should be limited to just enforcing that contract, whatever that agreement, that contract between you and Starlink was at the time.
Right. No, I get that. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned about the social difference between the socialism and the capitalism. And I can actually, even myself, if you think it off the top of your head, it totally made sense. And that's why the third way came about, with being more towards the fascistic yes. model than the socialist model, because of course, yes. or the communist model, because I mean, if you think about it critically, I mean, it makes sense that yes, of course, if you just appoint somebody as the head of this business that had no experience in it, then yeah, it's of course it's going to fail, which is why the communist model just does not work nearly as well. Whereas if you use, yeah, policy or legislation to control the corporation, but allow the CEOs their position to maintain the figureheads at the top, well, you can just control them by edict instead, right? So you don't have to install your puppet in the corporation per se. You can leave the guy as the CEO. You just control him by way of legislation. So I completely understand that. But once again, at least at this point in time, and I think we have a small window here where we can, because I have actually coined my own phrase here, where I think we're into the realm of, I call it, Enlightenment era 2.0. So, you know, the West went through an Enlightenment era, you know, a few hundred years ago, and it worked decently for a while when there were enough of the people, enough of the masses that were at least wise enough to kind of try to hold power at bay, at least try, attempt it. But once again, we are living in this modern age where we should fully take advantage of the fact, because like I say, I think the window is eventually going to close to the point where if we can get people up to speed on and to understand, like I say, what these terms mean, what the perils are of these P3 relationships, so that there isn't this transitional period where government is going to function in the background, but use the corporation as its facade, as its cover for continuing on doing the same thing, right? Right. So if we can do that today, just like when you abolish slavery, it's really about the person's intellect. It's about evolving your mindset. Nobody today, if you ask them, nobody today would say, oh yeah, I agree with slavery. We should have slaves. No, everyone, people from the left or the right, there might be some people who might secretly agree with it, but they will never say that publicly. Most people would openly admit and say, no, slavery is bad. Slavery is wrong. But that's the thing. Without that understanding, That's the only thing that really keeps full-on human ownership at bay is people's understanding of the ethical and moral implications of owning another human being. If we don't get the message out to enough people in enough time to explain them this, how this public partner, public-private partnership thing is basically creating a huge fascistic, you know, basically like a global fascistic state almost at this point in time, then we may miss that window of opportunity, and people will be lulled into by some people, some sophists, and some people who are really good at salesmanship and tactics of convincing people that, you know, even though their faith in government is subsiding, well, they're just going to replace that, right? Just like the king was replaced with the democracy. Well, they're just going to replace the state with the corporation that's going to be your new overlords. Now, once again, with the thing with the Elon Musk and the Starlink, well, that contract's already drawn up, and that's a good contract, and it was written by a guy that's actually antithetical to that kind of big government statism. But who's to say that that isn't going to happen with many other corporations going forward? And a lot of young people, if they're not properly informed, will accept it.
And I think one thing that's really resonates with a lot of people is healthcare and big pharma. And David, that's something I think you might want to discuss is, you know, how P3s tie into that. And I know we have a much different situation in Canada with public healthcare, right?
Mm.
So, well, it is a fascinating, and it's a great example of exactly what we're talking about. The public-private partnership in healthcare was absolutely brought to the fore with the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccine to do that in that, which was a program that was really begun by Donald Trump. He went out to contract, to use your word, on all the major companies to build a new vaccine. The price was several billion dollars, but here's the catch. Assuming that we don't know, I'm of the school that doesn't believe that we know the efficacy and safety, to use the government's terms, of the vaccine. Mm. We do know that about 36,000 people have died directly from the vaccine. Those are the numbers from the VAERS, the vaccine alerting system of the FDIC, of the government. We do know that 36,000 people have died, and that opens us up to legal liability. Somebody in this whole arrangement has liability for any harm done under the vaccines. Is that somebody the government, or is that somebody the big pharma companies like that produce the vaccine? And we don't really have an answer to that. I did want to kind of loop back then on just one thing. Bennett, you were kind of indicating that there's an open window for us to kind of escape this. And I think Canada is ahead of the United States in this whole process. What I'm really saying for the United States is, in the public-private partnership, we have a president who's pushing that to a fare-thee-well, and he is the one who is essentially running the corporations. He's the one who's setting the agenda, who's saying we should build electric vehicles under both Trump and Biden, are saying they should create the vaccines and so on. It's the government who is really running the corporations. And that concerns me a great deal. I'm afraid that is a direction that we don't want to go to. That's closer to the socialism control of the corporation that we were talking about earlier, and actually farther away from fascism.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually I can't even remember right now who it is that I could attribute this particular quote to. So I'll just kind of paraphrase, but it's more or less, I believe it was Milton Friedman, actually. He had mentioned at one point in time, and of course, like I say, I'm a fan of the objectivist philosophy and Ayn Rand and the whole Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead and the kind of stories and meta narratives that are contained within those amazing novels. But, I kind of lost my train of thought there. I lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
Hey, it happens. You know, happens to the best of us. Don't sweat it. Yeah.
I know where I was going. So now I know where I was going. So basically what he said, and this is something that I think is vitally important, especially for those people who are like your Elon Musk of the world. And I've seen, I hate to keep using him because he's already thrown enough skin in the game, and, you know, $44 billion to try to keep you know, X at least somewhat of a free speech platform. He's definitely got some skin in the game. But where are all these wealthy billionaires, right, that really should be market oriented, especially the ones that know they have, you know, a good business plan, proper products and services that are appealing to large masses and very profitable businesses? Where are these people in investing? Now, it might be something that happens more predominantly in the U.S. I'm not sure on that. But in Canada, it's severely lacking. There are people, there are voices like myself, and there's some really great people up here that say some great things, have some great shows and podcasts, and put out some great articles and information to try to educate and inform and enlighten people. But once again, we're basically strapped with very minimal resources because we live in a very top-down society that makes it so that you have to be willing to sell your soul to the proverbial devil in order to get. And some of us just aren't willing to do so. But I can say this with just using my own example. If I had any kind of resources, right, you know, put my way, I could put it to great use to try to help expand on not just my audience, but the kind of things, like I say, I'm an ideas guy and a problem solving guy. Like I say, I built my first engine when I was a teenager, and I love the ability of figuring out and solving problems. But once again, all problems require some kind of resources. In this modern capitalist world we live in, resources at the end of the day that underlines and pins all that stuff is the capital, the money. And that's somewhere where these businesses, at least the ones that want to, you know, venture and show their prowess in the market by actually functioning in a competitive free market environment, where are these people? Where is the investment that's taking place? And, you know, because they're busy running their business, but, you know, they should be, if they want to maintain a healthy, you know, any kind of market oriented system or what's left of it, well, you need to invest in not just your business, which is, of course, very important, but the people who are promoting the kind of market capitalism that you folks are going to benefit from. That's a big key factor there. Now, I don't know what it's like. I say, maybe you can answer this question for me. I would imagine, well, you got people like Peter Thiel and the such. And like I say, there's I think you folks have a pretty good space down there in terms of some great libertarians and some wealthy billionaires that definitely have the capital and the resources to put to good work and, you know, start up some of these great think tanks and such, or even some of these alternative social media outlets. Whereas here in Canada, that's one thing, you know, we might be maybe ahead in some areas, but we're way far behind in that kind of space.
So to answer your basic question here on why don't the billionaires do certain public behavior, it's because they don't want to. The game has changed. It's a dramatically different country and marketplace, if you will, than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Right now, the way the billionaire is most likely to make money has very little to do, unfortunately, and is steadily reducing to do with a free and open marketplace. Yeah. If he can sell the government to do a product, then he's going to be much better off. I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago about how Boeing has a tendency to always move next to their largest client. 21 years ago, their largest client was United Airlines. They moved from back in Washington, out in the state of Washington, to Chicago, Illinois, to be right next to United Airlines. Right now, the CEO, who was just incidentally fired but is still hanging around for another year, the CEO has just announced that they're going to move next to Washington, D.C. Why? Because it's the defense part of Boeing that makes the most money. The defense part of Boeing, with 16,000 employees, makes more money than the 44,000 that it takes to build an airplane. So what's he going to do? He's going to go right beside government. And that's the issue here that we're looking at behind all this. And we have a president who is enforcing the idea that he wants the corporate class to come be next to him and follow out what his objectives are. That's the problem.
Actually, you know what? That makes total sense. And while you're saying it, it actually started resonate with me before you even finished your phrase or your sentence there. But because really, when you think about it, this is the thing. So what I was originally thinking is, yes, that I'm thinking more of the entrepreneur type, because these are people like anyone that's competition oriented or driven. Like I say, and I'm using myself, my own analytical experience, and I have that competitive mindset. So I'm kind of projecting a little bit here myself. But I know myself, I would love to test my merit and my mettle, right? That would be the thing. But of course, now that I think about it, and with a little bit of help from you kind of further explaining it, actually, if you think about it, most of the corporations, we're not talking about a whole lot of new upstarts per se. We're talking about, you know, some very old corporations that, yeah, the original guys that started them, right, that had the proper ambition, the proper goals, more market competition-oriented exuberance. Yeah, they're now, yeah, the kind of people that are the CEOs, and we're definitely seeing that because now we're seeing a lot of these, even these DEI appointee type of CEOs and people in these boards. So yeah, they're not the people that started the business. So they have a completely, I agree with you there. They have a completely different outlook. They have a completely different history, a completely different way of doing business, as you say.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was just doing some research on Ronald Reagan. And the economy under Reagan was the polar opposite of what we see today. Reagan said government isn't the solution. Government is the problem. Mm. He said the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Mm-hmm. And that kind of sums it up. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the country back then, we had many more millionaires, many fewer billionaires. We didn't have the concentration of wealth that we have right now. We had exactly what you're talking about, Bennett. He reduced regulation, reduced taxes, and we had this flood of new entrepreneurs coming into the marketplace. Think about all of those technology companies. They probably began somewhere in the 80s, certainly by the 90s. The internet came in 1994. That's all the wave of the Reagan entrepreneurship coming into the marketplace. And it was a free marketplace at the time. Now we have a government where we're shutting down entrepreneurs because we're adding taxes, we're adding regulation. And what we have instead is the crony capitalists, the very, very wealthy, whose marketplace is the U.S. government.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that really is the key factor then, isn't it? And I suppose because of the current system that we function under, that's the thing. I usually typically say, and I like to, you know, I think it was Andrew Breitbart that coined the phrase, you know, politics is downstream of culture. And it most certainly is. It most certainly is. But I guess when it comes to these P3s and in terms of the market, because the government genuinely is and people's belief in that authority. So government is, you know, the one that sets the rules for the marketplace these days. So I guess in a way that is one area that I would say that, you know, perhaps that's one area in the economic realm where there may very well be at least some initial aspect in terms of, it's not that the politics is the solution, but it's the politics, which includes, you know, getting rid of the red tape or, you know, lessening the barrier to entry for entrepreneurs and new upstarts and businesses. So I guess that is one area where, you know, you don't have to even just talk like people like myself, like talk about things from the macro or the philosophical aspect. It actually, that's one realm that, yes, people could get actively involved, whether you're political or economic in nature, whether it's, you know, lobbying efforts or, you know, through the voting or the ballot, is, yes, getting somebody, right? Once again, not that I'm a big fan of anyone government, but if you could do anything at all, I believe, to open up the marketplace of ideas and the actual marketplace itself, I believe, like you say, that massive growth spurt that took place under Reagan, I believe there's a lot of pent up innovation that would be unleashed. But I think another big problem with that, and I think why a lot of the people that are currently in power wouldn't want that to take place. And as great as it would sound in the onset for us, I can't help but think that, wow, with the current economic system, the financial system and the fiat currency, the current Ponzi scheme is, boy, that would certainly unleash a lot of inflation. And I think that would probably really, really concern and upset the apple cart of the central planners.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you look back at the history, during the 1970s was one of the absolute worst economic times in our history. It broke. We had an incredible economy coming out of World War II. Growth was beyond trend throughout the entire time until we got to the 1970s, and then that broke. And the reason it broke was because we had a guy back then by the name of Lyndon Johnson who said we can have both guns and butter. We can have the Great Society, and we can also fight the war in Vietnam. And we can do this even though we have tremendous government deficits. And so what we suffered through in the 1970s was the hangover from Lyndon Johnson's presidency, And what that hangover was the horrible combination of inflation and poor productivity, something economists did not believe could possibly exist. And they gave it a new name. The new name was stagflation. Mm-hmm. That's a name we have not heard until Joe Biden became president and they brought it out of the attic and said, oh yeah, we got stagflation again. High inflation, poor productivity. The combination of the Federal Reserve taking interest rates to sky high and Reagan creating an environment for productivity by reducing regulation and by lowering taxes, which incidentally was the same thing Margaret Thatcher was doing over in Great Britain. That combination broke the back of stagflation and created the productivity that we had, I think, for the next 20 or 30 years. Unfortunately, it lasted a very short time until Reagan's vice president, George H.W. Bush, became president, and he raised taxes. Bill Clinton came in later, created the public-private partnership concept, and started increasing regulation, and they both were increasing the role of government in the economy, and it kind of broke some of the momentum. But that's where we are today, too.
Hey, David, actually, since you're an American, actually, let me ask you this question. I should know this myself, but it's just there's so many things that we try to keep on top of. And if you don't know, that's fine, too. But I just remember, I believe, actually, when Trump was in his first term, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure if it was an executive order. If it actually got done, I just remember it being bantered about. Not sure if it's still on the books today. But wasn't there something where for any legislation passed or anything like that, you had to get rid of two laws? Yeah. Or there was something along those lines. Do you know if that ever actually took off? Because I think that would have been, you know, another something to lower the barrier to entry in a lot of this bureaucracy and red tape is this, just to eliminate so many of these, I mean, multiple redundant barriers and obstacles to entry for entrepreneurs and young upstarts.
Bennett, I hope you know that Trump loves you by saying his first term, implying that he's going to have a next one here shortly. That's the sunset laws have been rumored for a long time. They actually tried to start that all the way back in Reagan's era, and that is to make these regulations so they do. They would expire after a while. I don't believe that any of the sunset law concepts have ever been passed, and I think As your friend Milton Friedman, you just mentioned a moment ago, Friedman said something about the next thing to immortality is a temporary regulation.
Right.
That's how America is today, unfortunately. It's regrettable, frankly.
Yeah, actually, talking about the temporary thing, it's one of the posts that I've put up on X in recent months, and it actually took off, and I'm glad to see that a lot of people got a chance to read it. But here in Canada in 1917, it was 1913 down in the U.S., but yeah, they set up the good old income tax, right? And it was sold here in Canada as a temporary war measures act, right? Yeah. And if you actually read through the document, which you can, and I have it on all my social media pages, and you can find it to go to canada.com. It's the, like I say, just type in the War Measures Act. You'll get the PDF. You can download and check it all out. But it was, I think if I remember correctly, I might be a little bit off by a percent or two, but I believe at the time, the income tax, you know, it was sold under the guise of you got to pay for the war, right? So already, you know, you're talking about war. But it was, I believe, for wealthy individuals, I believe it was 2%. And I think the corporations with 3%. Yes. To the point where today, you know, like the average, I think the Fraser Institute last time, one I seen, the average household, you know, in taxes pays more. We pay more now in taxes than we do for the house, you know, our food, our fuel, and our clothing and all that stuff combined. Yeah. So to me, it's just, it's just awe-inspiring sometimes in a negative way, I would say, to see just how far people have fallen away from or shied away from having that competition-oriented mindset. Because we all know that's if you talk to anyone at the individual level, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that would say, oh, no, competition is bad. Everyone has personal anecdotal experiences or examples in their life where competition has always gained and elevated. You could be, you'd be hard pressed to find any example where competition, right, lowered standards in some way. Matter of fact, you'd be really, really, I actually challenge someone to just come up with one example. So people automatically and instinctively know this, yet they've been so seemingly programmed with the rhetoric of the Keynesians and the big government proponents and the collectivists that they seemingly will reject that kind of just blatant honesty and things that they should know intrinsically that make sense, but they'll reject it outright, which is why, the whole government thing, I'm one of those libertarians. It's just like a cult. It's a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. No, I agree. You're exactly right. And you're exactly right about the income tax. It was, at least in the U.S. here, also 2%, and it was only above a certain fairly hefty income. You had to have make a fair amount of money. 1913 was also, of course, the year the Federal Reserve came in, and they both came in under a fairly weak, diminished mental president by the name of Woodrow Wilson, who the rumor at the time was that his wife was probably running it. Certainly that Wilson was not capable of running the government himself. So the question was who was doing it. But you're right about, it's a remarkable thing when the free enterprise system is opened up and people are given some economic freedom and the ability to become entrepreneurs or to become the best worker they can be. It's incredible. I think both the Canadian population and the American population can create incredible wealth, incredible prosperity, but the government has to get out of the way. And that's the problem.
I agree. Let's make this happen as quickly as possible. I wish, right? I wish I could just, possibly snap my finger and that would be the case. But that is the major issue. And once again, with all these P3s, like I say, you're having too many people that are and that's what I'm worried about is some of these young people that want to start these business, they almost have no choice and they see it. And I think it's just soul crushing for some of them is they want to. Well, I mean, I even have a friend, you might even know him. I'm not sure if any of you folks know him. He used to be the leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada. His name's Tim Moen, great guy and a libertarian himself. And, He's a volunteer firefighter and a paramedic in Alberta up around the patch. I believe he still lives up around Fort McMurray.
Neat.
Anyways, but he constantly, and he actually has two daughters, and I'm not sure if his wife is as well, but he has two daughters that are, I believe they're both paramedics in the healthcare field as well. And he's constantly talking about like how many examples where, he could help so many other people by having, rather than him dealing with the bureaucracy and spending so much time on redundant layers of paperwork and all this stuff and the crap that the government puts you through the ringers, right? The bureaucracy of it all. You spend so much time with that and only a portion of your time actually helping people. Whereas, in a private market oriented type of a system, a private system, your customer, I know it's not the greatest way to claim it, but the patient is basically, and in a business, that comes first. That comes first and foremost. And it actually would actually create more innovation in the healthcare fields. Now, I'm not sure about you folks in the United States, but in Canada, and I live in New Brunswick, the crazy part about it, our healthcare system here in New Brunswick, and I couldn't believe it at the time, we were only just over 100 and they had it set at 200. So once it got to 200 people, and we have multiple hospitals, like quite a few, I mean, not a massive amount, but our major cities like your Fredericton, Moncton, St. John, Miramichi, there's many, like quite a few hospitals, but just a couple hundred people with COVID were enough to overwhelm and almost shut down the healthcare system, which tells you that, this three P's where government and these businesses are in bed together, it's not functioning good. And even the people that care so much about their healthcare in Canada, which is the preponderance of most Canadians and particularly the older people, right? I'm still shocked.
Yes.
I'm still shocked how anyone could possibly support, this current system when they're the ones, it's their future lives. It's their future health that's going to be put in peril. And we've seen how detrimental that was through the whole COVID-19 thing. I mean, it wasn't just the people who were affected with COVID, but it was all the countless surgeries that were postponed, put off, delayed, and all the other things that took place because of this massively failed system. And like someone like Tim Moen that has all these skills, has that entrepreneurial zeal and mindset, It's illegal for him. It's illegal for him to create a much better healthcare system, or at least something to compete with the public system. It's literally illegal for that man. So it's in Canada, it's illegal to help people's health out or to give them a better health outcome or option. And that, to me, I find most devastating.
I absolutely agree. As one of those elderly people you were talking about who's concerned about health, that fits me to a T, Bennett. So you're right on the money. But the thing is, when you see this increase of regulation and when you see the difficulty with which young people can become entrepreneurs, the way to really view that is what you're really seeing is they're raising the bar. They're making entry into that field more and more difficult, progressively more difficult. Who are the likely candidates who want to see the bar raised? Why, it's the people who are already in the system and very successful, of which the chief person that I can think of off the top of my head is one Bill Gates, who Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the largest foundation, I believe, in the world, certainly the largest foundation in America. I used to be a treasurer for a 501c3, which is the tax code number for not-for-profits. Yeah. And we always looked for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as the way to run a foundation. And indeed, in terms of finance and everything, they are number one. Bill Gates said when a couple of years ago, and I'm paraphrasing, that he certainly liked not-for-profit healthcare because it was so much more profitable than the software business that he used to be in. Remember, he was the founder of Microsoft. The reason is because a lot of these, quote, crony capitalists, these people who are very closely tied in with the government, have encouraged the government to raise the standards. And as those standards are raised, your friend Mr. Moen up there has to fill out more papers, do more work, makes it harder and harder for him to actually perform what he's doing. That has become what this system wants. The system wants to prevent people like that from really having access because the people who've already made it are setting the rules.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, the whole problem, obviously, not just with government, but these P3s, it's the incentive structure that it creates. That is the most perilous part of it. And when you hear even when people are talking about, you know, in terms of, you know, oh, there's a lack of this, or we just don't have enough people for this. That to me is a complete failure in an analysis of the situation. Because I think anyone critically thinking about anything, whether you're talking about economics or pretty much any even social aspect, is you can incentivize people to do a lot of things. And obviously what's taking place is incentivizing bad behaviors, malinvestment, you know, enriching, you know, greatly. It's a zero-sum game, basically how it's set up. So someone's benefiting at someone else's expense. Whereas in an actual market, you know, oriented kind of setting, it's a win-win, right? We both walk away feeling like we've both benefited from that exchange. And that's the thing about the market, which I believe is so important. But once again, without somebody, you know, at the mechanisms, at the helm, at the controls, right, of the economy, without someone taking their hands off and allowing that kind of innovation and entrepreneurship to actually flourish, well, yeah, you're basically going to end up with the people who do have these bold ideas or initiatives are going to be relegated to either, you know, traveling to maybe other jurisdictions that are maybe more oriented towards, you know, allowing them to the freedom to you know, dip their toes in the entrepreneurial water kind of thing. And we're going to have that kind of brain drain even in the West. Now, we've benefited from brain draining from other countries, but I believe we're actually, it may very well end up flipping. I'm not saying it's going to happen anytime soon, but I'm even kind of seeing that a little bit today in Canada, because you're seeing, especially the investors, they don't even want to really invest a whole lot of money because of the uncertainty, because of just how crazy the policies have been in recent years, and particular underneath the Trudeau Liberals. So I can understand if I was a wealthy investor, where I would rather save my time, energy, and resources and capital and invest that elsewhere. Might not even be in one of our you know, more advanced democracy such as Canada, the U.S. I mean, I can imagine now if I had a big store of capital, I might be looking down to Argentina right about now.
Well, Bennett, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said in this crony capitalist system, this public-private partnerships type setup, that it is considered a zero-sum game. You're absolutely right. And I do believe that that's the way the elites in this country have now begun to see our economy as a zero-sum game. And you're again right that if we would make it a free and open marketplace, that we could see growth across the board. And I think you're seeing that basically in all the macro numbers if you go back long enough and see a big enough trend. Now, here's a scary thought. In Japan, you know, everyone's concerned about disease X, quote unquote, something that is going to hit us sometime around the fall or winter of this coming year. Japan has already announced that they believe disease X is here and that it is a self-replicating disease. In other words, it's COVID-19 on steroids, something that will replicate within the system and make it even worse than it is now. They're developing a vaccine against it, which will also be a self-replicating thing. But the thing to consider, and I'm not in that science. I don't know that science at all. But right. For us who are lay people looking into that, something like that, they're already creating the demand for a vaccine, for a disease that does not yet exist, for a vaccine that does not yet exist, but they're creating and building a demand for it. And that's the amount of control that you can see in this kind of a crony capitalist private public partnership type setup.
Yeah, this is like a tease phase in a marketing campaign almost. Yes. It's like, oh, disease X is coming out soon, guys. Better get ready. You know, it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, that's really disturbing. And I've seen that too. And I've even got a little bookmark folder from the few times that disease X has been mentioned so far, just so I have something to refer to for the potential chance that you know, that's something that might take center stage, not too far down the line. Right. I mean, once again, I don't typically, like I say, I'm not into obviously, you know, wild conspiracy theories, but that's the thing, you don't have to. And the sad part is that term gets bantered around too much anyways, because to pretend that people don't want I just say rational self-interest, fuck conspiracy theories. I just know how that humans are fallible. I know they have the capacity to be good, but they also have the capacity to be very bad. And rational self-interest can work to be in positive ways, but it can also work to very, very negative ways. And yeah, there's a lot of people. I mean, look at how COVID, I mean, that big experiment, I'm sure they were even shocked themselves. I mean, some of these central planners are big farm. They must have been even shocked, or maybe not. I'm not sure. I can't say that I'm in their minds, in their headspace. But I mean, it was quite an experiment. I know for me to watch how it all unfolded, because it wasn't just something that you were looking from beyond. It wasn't on a TV screen only. You could actually experience that in your own life, and I'm sure each and every one of us did, where people that you actually know in your own physical space, in your own realm, were like they were programmed overnight to literally lack any critical thinking skills whatsoever. And it was that fear. And we all know, I mean, we've all heard the stories. We've probably all read the books. The history's all there. This is like a lot of this stuff. There's nothing really new under the sun in how easy it is. I mean, just even read Machiavelli propaganda, right? Read any of these. It's really easy. You stir up the fear. The recipe's there. They know how to whip people up into a frenzy, create the whole divide and conquer. They're playing the identity politics, and then you add that extra layer of fear of the unknown and a virus. Geez, what better thing to use than an invisible thing, right? Like that's, mm-hmm. That really puts people on heightened state of alert. And just like a herd of anything, you know, in large numbers and quantities in a heightened state of fear, people will be acceptable and adopt basically anything if they believe that it's going to benefit them or protect them in some way. Cause that's that rational self-interest of the person, the individual doing whatever they can to save themselves. And we all know that's going to take place, but we're not talking about currently in a market environment. We're talking about people who are using their rational self-interest or what they perceive as their rational self-interest, but with the big gigantic metaphorical gun in the room, which is government at their disposal, which makes them very dangerous.
And it went so far beyond the vaccine itself. It went into a lot of economic policies like wearing masks, social distancing, isolation, and so on. The second quarter of 2020 was the worst quarter this nation has ever existed. Had we gone for an entire year like we did in the second quarter of 2020, the market or the economy would have been down one third. What people forget is that a lot of those non-essential businesses were shut down, and it turned out they were shut down for good. We've still lost a whole group of mom and pop entrepreneur businesses, like the little local coffee shop or the barber shop and so on. Those are gone. And part of the reason that we're having all of the problems in all the big cities like San Francisco, New York, and so on, is that they lost all of that infrastructure. They also lost all of the people who then started working from home and not coming back into the offices. But it was an incredible economic policy that really set this country on its ear. And I think in a large part, it's why we've seen government leaders like the president really pick up and run with the ball now, because I think he's being told by his economic advisors, if you don't run with the ball in government, we no longer have those small little mom and pop businesses to keep the economy going. And it was a huge, huge blow to this guy, to this country, actually.
Hey, sorry to interrupt, guys. We're 10 past the hour. I know you all have your own schedules and so on, but I thought we'd take a little time. We have a request here for a question. Do you mind if we open it up for Q&A?
No, oh, great. That'd all be right.
I'm going to bring on Vaughn here. One moment. Vaughn, you should be connecting. Feel free to unmute and speak. If you can find the unmute button, it should be in the bottom left. You want to just tap that. You should be able to talk to us. There you go. Can you testing 1, 2, 3? Can you speak?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good.
Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I have a probably more of a question of philosophy, basically, I suppose. But it looks as if we're entering into what I would call the new Gilded Age, like, you know, the ages of like, you know, Vanderbilt and J.P. Morgan, and we, you know, where they just ran everything. And I think at one time J.P. Morgan had more Pinkertons than the New York had police officers.
Yes.
And I was wondering how did we get out of that? So what is the recipe? Because somehow that turned around. Was it because of government?
Wow, that's a great question. An interesting question. Or was it because that other, what do they call them, robber barons, outfought the original robber barons? And that may look like what it is today. I mean, the accumulation and concentration in this of wealth in this country is really, I think, unmatched even by the Gilded Age.
You're right.
You know, it's absolutely incredible. And what's phenomenal, or it seems like most of the economic policies, for instance, there's an income tax. Who does that affect? That affects the middle class working individual. There is no wealth tax. Even though they keep talking about it, there is no wealth tax. And generally speaking, although Biden is kind of changing that, tax on capital gains and so on is much less than most income tax. So it seems like our policies in terms of economic policies, we no longer care about how wealthy some individuals become or how concentrated that wealth is. And instead, we're trying to make our government dollars come off of the middle class. So I don't know.
Wow. May I say one more thing and then I'll mute myself, I promise.
Yeah, go ahead.
I saw Victor Davis Hanson giving a very long discussion about General Sherman's march through the South during the Civil War.
Right.
And he mentioned the fact that he thought, and I guess he's probably right, the South did not have a middle class. They had a gilded aristocracy and the low class whites and then the slaves. And so that may be a bit of a lesson for us. You know, the North had a middle class and they won.
Yes. Yes. And it's been the middle class that's been the driver behind this country for forever, basically. It was the middle class that won World War I and World War II. No, it's interesting. I was in Atlanta many years ago, and they still talk about Sherman's march to the sea and how incredibly brutal that was.
All right. Hey, thanks, Vaughn. And, you know, I have a question.
kind of almost like a closing statement. And any of the other listeners, feel free to request if you want to come up and speak. Just hit that button. But I want to know, just for the average person, do you have any advice to sort of navigate these perils of public-private partnerships, like from a consumer or citizen point of view, you know?
Bennett?
Oh, you want me to go? Okay, sorry, I thought he was asking you. Okay. Well, to me, I just like I say, on my personal individual level, I typically would tend to, and I do, I vote with my dollars, is I tend to support, you know, the businesses or the people. And once again, there's certain segments in the economy that in depend on what country and where you cannot escape it. But if there's any segment of the economy where people can function in a little bit something closer, like I say, there's not really a genuine free market, but something at least in the realm where there's a little bit more competition, I would tend to support those who are actually, like I say, more liberty oriented. And there's plenty of them. There's plenty of them out there that are trying to, they're finding their own way to be viable in this current crazy system. And anything that we as the consumers can do to help support them, right? That's the thing. I mean, you know, the voting, you know, that's something that we're not going to have any control over. You know, government, you know, is something that it's here until people no longer have this need or belief in it. And in the interim, like I say, is there's going to be disruptions going to take place anyway. Just kind of what the guy was alluding to earlier is, yeah, even greedy people are a little bit competitive with each other. So they might stab each other in the back enough that might upset the apple cart once in a while. But in the interim, like I say, support the kind of people. If you aren't yourself in the position to, you know, start your own business, because that's the other thing. You know, people on the left talk about tearing things down. As a libertarian, I have no wish to waste any time or energy tearing anything down. What I want to do is build alongside, right? Or to give options to people, because I believe people, once again, I understand humans at their core. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, never played one on TV, but I do understand rational self-interest. And if you give people, you know, actual something to be in competitive anyway against the status quo or the establishment, they will tend to gravitate towards that. At least anything that can happen. There's going to be areas where there's going to be so many barriers and obstacles that there might be areas in the economy where it's just almost impossible to do so. But anyone that you know or any business or upstart or even an existing business, even if it's part of a legacy business or a corporation, but they're more on the side of liberty or market-oriented competition, support them. Support them, and I mean seriously, not just with, hey, thanks. No, but you literally have to vote with your dollars, because that at the end of the day is where, now of course, it's not necessarily the will of all people, because when people talk about the will of the people, there's going to be some people who are going to be for that, but there's going to be a whole lot of people who would rather get, you know, take the free ride, right? So it's not, but what we've all understood is, just like with anything, competition is, we might be a minority. Like if you're in a race, if you're the winner of a race, you are the minority. You are literally the minority, right? But think about that person is actually, even though they're the minority, they're a winner by sheer of their own competence, of their own skills. So there might be a minority of people that are more market oriented in terms of the business realm these days, but they can definitely punch way above their weight. And once again, I'll just bring up Elon one more time, since we are on the man's platform after all, as he's just one of those examples. And not only is he out there creating alternative businesses, I mean, us libertarians, I'm very happy to be able to say these days that, you know what? You don't need government to go to space. You don't need government to have telecommunication, right? These are beautiful things to be able to show real world examples where a business can do anything that historically, especially in our country, used to be, oh, only government could do that. So it's a beautiful thing to do that. And anything that we can do to support these people that are out there, not just creating the businesses, but Elon is out there even saying some great things that's very helpful to market competition. And he even himself says he would invite competition, which is, like I say, which is why we should be supporting not just him or the others or your Peter Thiels or your Peter Schiffs or anyone out there that is genuinely market driven and willing to upset the apple cart in terms of the status quo of the establishment. Support them with your dollars as much as you can.
I would agree with Bennett 100% that we should support the local business and the local guy, the entrepreneur who's trying to get off the dime. I'm a little cautious, however, when it comes to any of these mega elites. in government. I point out that a lot of what we're seeing in the very, very, very wealthy, the tip top of the pyramid, are people who have learned how to take advantage and have been given advantage by government, government subsidies, government tax breaks, and so on and so forth. So I'm a little cautious about that. Mm. In general, I think we're at a time when we need to reform this system. That the system is certainly not responsive to we the people. It's responsive to the donor class. And I think that there's two things that we absolutely have to do. One, recognize that there's danger in the concentration of wealth and power that we have going on in this country right now. That's a dangerous situation, and that people can lead us down the wrong road who have too much influence. And I point again to the fact that Ford is projecting to lose $4.5 billion because Joe Biden had a great idea that it would be wonderful if we went green and had electric vehicles and had half of the cars in the country sold like that. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, I think we need to go beyond just voting and try and make our voices heard by either writing, calling, emailing local representatives, and get at the most local place you can get, the local city government, county government, whatever you're involved in, all the way up to the very top. And I think we need to become more vocal as people. And I think if that happens, that it won't be a cure-all. It won't be easy. It'll be very difficult, but I it's the only way I see, frankly, right now.
All right. Hey, thanks, guys. I think we should wrap it up soon, but I want to plug a few things first. And I'd like everybody listening, if you don't already follow Bennett or David, please go follow them now. And you two, you know, you're not just on Twitter. You're not just on ThinkSpot. You have other things going on. Bennett, you have a show. David, you're writing stuff. If you all want to promote anything you're doing, please go ahead.
Yeah. You want to go ahead, David, or?
You know, you go ahead, Bennett. I'm trying to think of what I'm on.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm basically, so I go by the username Canadian Libertarian. Unfortunately, someone took that on me on X, so it's C-A-N underscore Libertarian. But on everything else, like your Facebooks and your YouTube and Rumble, I'm on Odyssey as well. They're all under the username Canadian Libertarian, and you'll see my ugly mug there. I show myself. I don't hide behind a wall of anonymity like most of my opponents. I show myself for who I am. And of course, those are my, like I say, Facebook, YouTube, and then, of course, X is where I spend a lot of my time. But those are pretty much the main places that you can find me. And, of course, I do. If you go on any of my socials, you can also, if you need to email me, there's always links to my email as well. So anyone that does want to reach out to me, you can find me, like I say, at Canadian Libertarian on pretty much all the major social media platforms.
And Bennett, just one thing, is your show on Rumble and all that, do you live stream or is it like a pre-recorded? How is the format on that?
Yeah, I always do live streams. I used to do a bunch of pre-record stuff. There's a lot of things, but these days I just prefer the long form conversation. I like things that aren't cut up or edited. Matter of fact, I like to come into a conversation. I usually tell most of my guests, don't even want to have any setup or anything. We're just going to start it because I want it to be as natural. And there's a lot of people out in this space that are doing the same thing. I want my audience to see that it's, you know, this is as natural as just two people wanting to have a conversation. That's why I like the long form, unedited, right? And that's usually how I do it these days. And like I say, I'm willing to, if anyone out there that's listening to this, I am a libertarian, but I've put this out there multiple times. I'm willing to talk with anybody, you know, because really at the end of the day, when you're discussing ideas, I don't really care where your history, your politics, or even your ideology per se, as long as you're willing to engage in a discussion, or even if you're adversarial in some way, engage in the battle of ideas. Because once again, I believe that's the best place for the best ideas to actually take root and to flourish, is to actually for people to engage in them and for them to actually come to light.
Well, for me, the best place to find me is actually ThinkSpot. I think I write a column and occasionally do a podcast, and it's a pre-recorded podcast. So I haven't quite evolved up into the live podcasting yet, except right here. This is the first time.
Well, yeah, this is a good format for it, because it just records, and you could take that and just upload it to your podcast feed later too. So if you ever want to do a live sort of thing,
great.
And I want to promote one more thing. So since
you actually, Nathan, before Nathan, I have to apologize because stupid me. I overlooked the fake spot because actually, because I was when you were talking about that, I was thinking about the stuff in terms of using my show and my audio and stuff. Predominantly ThinkSpot is where, and I'm very, once again, let me just say, I'm very thankful for you folks that set up ThinkSpot, because ThinkSpot is that one place where I can go. I'm not much into typing and texting, right? I probably wouldn't make much of a writer, but that is the one place if I want to put my thoughts down into words, and I am starting to share some of my other material on ThinkSpot now, but that is the one place if I want to share my thoughts and articulate my thoughts in a text-oriented manner, where I found that is the one place where I can go and do so. And sure, I'll get some pushback. You know, there'll be some people who have some disagreements, but I'm treated with respect and dignity. There isn't a bunch of trolls. ThinkSpot, as far as I'm concerned, and like I say, I would have mentioned that early on, but I was kind of thinking I'm in a different space in terms of, you know, the audio and video. But yeah, ThinkSpot is definitely an excellent site for anyone that's even into ideas and discussing, whether it's philosophy or politics or history and that stuff, where not only can you get your voice out there to other people listening to, but you'll be actively engaged in some really great dialogue and conversation. So once again, thanks for you folks that do run ThinkSpot over there. And I'm really appreciative to have that site as well.
Thanks. Yeah, we really appreciate hearing that. And now is actually a great time to go there, because we just opened the door to writers access for like a month, because we're doing a writing competition. We just announced it today. There's a grand prize opportunity for $1,000.
Wow.
And if you don't get the grand prize, there's a second prize, 500, and then the third prize, 100. And there's some other, you know, goodies along with that, like a lifetime writing account on ThinkSpot and features in the newsletter and so on. So if you want to try it out, if you've never written on there, you can actually try writing now for free. And if you want to join the competition, you get a chance to actually make some money too. So go check it out, thinkspot.com. The contest should be on there. We promoted that on our social too. If you want to check our feed here on X or Twitter, we'll put it up on our pinned, as our pinned post right after we finish this. So David and Bennett, I appreciate your time. That was great conversation we had here. And if there's any final things you want to say, go ahead. Otherwise, I think we can just kind of wrap up.
All right. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to echo what Bennett was saying about thank you both. It's been a great time.
Yeah, and Nathan, once again, actually, it's funny you mentioned that contest, because actually I was doing, I had to do an interview with another guy, Toward Anarchy, earlier. I actually just saw that on my timeline, and I quickly shared it, and I'm going to go back actually after I'm done this, or maybe I'll wait till the morning and check that out, because actually that's something that really did entice me, because yeah, that the writing thing, like I said, I've done it, and even people that have known me, like, well, why don't you like to write? You seem to do fairly well when you do it. So I might actually take you folks up on that offer, and I like that idea of that competition once again, because that's a beautiful thing. That's going to put me in that kind of mindset where I'm going to want to put my best foot forward. So thanks once again for you folks for doing that, and the fact that I might even get myself some bucks out of it, even better.
And it's only 1,000 words, you know, like, or under. So, you know, you don't have to write a whole book. So that's another benefit of this. All right. Well, thanks for the kind word, guy. Kind words. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you all later. Why don't we end it here? All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Nice meeting y'all.